So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, now an emeritus professor, our guest as he often comes by to talk about what's going on in wildlife here in the state. Always fun to have him stop by, and certainly you may have a question for him about something you've seen, maybe a problem that's developed, maybe a cool experience that you've had. You may have some cool wildlife photos. I hope you'll post those up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's where you can also post some questions. And you can post an email at talk@wpr.org. But we also always love to hear your voice. So call 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Scott, welcome back.
Well, thanks. It's nice to be back, Larry. I mean, here it is, May 4th, and I've got to do this. I've got to do it. May the 4th be with you.
Oh.
I've heard that about 15 times already this morning, but anyway. Well, I'm back in the sense of on the radio, but I'm also back as of last night from Texas, down there doing some work with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Division. Holy cow, Texas is like a different place.
Yeah, a little bit different, and their wildlife issues are a little different than
their
ours.
Their wildlife issues are very different, but nice group of people, and I think I'll be doing a little work down there. It should be fun.
Well, one thing that they probably are very similar, the Texas is similar to Wisconsin in that they have a lot of baby wildlife probably running around about now, and with the wildlife, seems to come some issues. I saw online somebody had grabbed up, was it 5 coyote pups?
Pups?
Little really? Pups, because supposedly the mother had abandoned them.
Well,
yes,
this is a topic that's always near and dear to my heart in the spring, but it's especially relevant in that on the way to the airport Sunday to fly to Texas, I was nearly taken out on East Washington Avenue by a massive traffic pileup. And I mean, literally, I missed a guy in front of me by about a frog hair. But and I said, what the heck's going on here? We're right in the middle of a block. Well, it was a mother mallard and two little fuzzball ducklings made it across 6 lanes of East Washington.
Yeah.
Amazing. Everybody stopped, which was impressive, actually. And they slowly waddled off and disappeared to the south of East Washington. But I'm surprised there wasn't actually some car contact there. And, you know, and maybe even somebody injured. So the moral of the story is while it's gratifying to see that people are willing and interested in helping baby wildlife or something they perceive as injured or in trouble, you have to use some common sense, kind of like helping those turtles across the road with the nesting season coming up here in a few weeks.
Yeah.
Don't stop in the middle of 70-mile-an-hour traffic on the interstate if there's some risk of a problem.
Yeah.
But the as you alluded to, for most of these animals, whether they're ducklings or songbirds or coyote pups or anything else or fawns, when you find one, the odds are way in favor of the fact that they're not abandoned or orphaned, that the parent animal or animals is simply not present at the time, and they'll be revisited. Just like uncovering a nest of nestling rabbits, cottontail rabbits in your backyard, now that people are starting to mow and do yard work, you know, you find a little, what's this dead vegetation, and peel it back, and there's 4 or 5 squirming little rabbits. You know, those are not abandoned rabbits. That's the way the female does it. They're left there, and then they're visited at night for nursing. And, you know, grabbing them up, thinking they've got to be taken in and kept warm and fed, is not in their best interest and not in yours either. So, in general, the rule of thumb is leave them alone unless you are certain that, gee, there's mother duck that met with an accident in the road, and the ducklings are huddled up against the curb, imminently about to fall in a storm sewer. Then in that case, you intervene. But generally,
leave them alone. Well, Hal in Stoughton has something that relates directly to that. So let's go to Hal. Hi, Hal. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yeah, I have a question. I have a lot of baby rabbits around my property in Stoughton. And I cornered one in my garden the other day, and it didn't know what to do, and I just reached down and petted it a little bit. And I told my brother-in-law, who lives out in Colorado, that I did this. And he says, oh, no, don't do that. They've had a couple of people die because of a rabbit disease that transmits to people if you pet them. I never heard of such a thing.
And that makes two of us, Hal.
Yeah, I've never heard of such a thing either.
Although
I remember Jimmy Carter being chased while he was in a canoe by a... Remember that story?
Yeah. Well, Hal, I guess the moral of the story here relates back to what we just said is, you know, leave them alone, basically.
Yeah.
And that includes not picking them up trying to become a surrogate mother rabbit, but it also means leave them alone in terms of not handling petting or whatever else. I didn't think that's where your story was headed, actually, because
sure.
most gardeners' relationships to rabbits is apparently just a little more rocky than yours, yes. So I thought the question was, okay, we found a litter of rabbits in the garden, next to the garden, or close to the garden. What the heck do I do with them? That's another problem, and since you're not asking that question, I'm going to avoid answering it.
There you go.
But I don't know about the disease you're talking about.
I haven't heard anything about that.
I think that the best thing to do is just leave these things alone, and I don't know. In the last 2 weeks, I've handled baby rabbits myself in my own garden, and now I'm nervous. There's something going on, Larry.
I tell you,
hey guys, I now do straw bale gardening.
Yep.
So I don't have to worry about them.
You're exactly right. I don't either.
Now, since you brought that up, Hal, are you pretty happy with the straw bale technique?
I haven't gotten anything to grow yet. I just started.
Oh, okay.
So,
I've had a great couple of years with straw bale gardening. I love it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so. I've got the bales out, and I'm just getting ready to get going, so I was curious about your experience.
Yeah.
Well, get that soaker hose and a timer.
Yeah.
Okay.
And some fertilizer, nitrogen fertilizer right now. And that's a whole other show, so we'll go on to something else. Thanks a lot, Hal, for calling. Appreciate it. I have not heard of any disease being passed on from rabbits to people.
Well, the famous one is tularemia, which is an issue primarily with transfer of parasites. It's a flea or tick issue.
All right, well,
that's a fall issue. Well, it's a warm season issue, and that's why the rabbit season generally opens late in the year historically, because those parasites have been diminished by cold, and then it's easier for people to deal with them. But maybe that's what Hal heard about, but the bottom line is if you leave them alone, you don't have to worry about any of these things, and they don't have to worry about dealing with human help either.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks again, Hal, for calling. And David emailed to say the Orioles have arrived in Waukesha, and George V. Kalik, rest his soul, always told me when I had him on, he always looked for the return of the Orioles to Milwaukee as a sure sign of spring, the Baltimore Orioles.
I've been waiting for hours. I've got the grape jelly ready, and I'm just ready to mobilize. I'm waiting for the Orioles, and I'm waiting for my pair of rose-breasted grosbeaks, which have been just regular visitors for the last 5 or 6 years. I haven't seen them either.
Have you seen anything kind of unusual yet?
Yesterday I had an indigo bunting on the feeder,
which is nice. Pretty
cool.
Yeah.
A beautiful bird, not very commonly seen. I've had tufted titmice the last week or so, which I don't usually see, although other people do. And the usual suspects beyond that, but an incredible number of goldfinches this year.
Oh.
It just looks like a convention of canaries at the feeder right now with bright yellow males. So if other callers are seeing cool stuff coming through or at their feeders, this is a really good time of the year for birding.
You know, I had the gourd gal appear on my show to talk about gourds during a garden talk show, and she handed over a really cool gourd that was kind of curling and so forth, but it had a nice little ball center, you know. So I took it home, and it was dried, obviously. I took it home, and I cut an inch hole in the side and drilled three holes in the bottom. I stuck it in the tree right next to the house. Not even a day later, I had two chickadees.
That's cool.
So they made a nest, and they're nesting in the in the gourd right next to the house. And I've, of course, I've got a bird feeder right there, and I've got water, a bird bath. So they've got everything they need.
Certainly, as long as we're on the subject, I mean, it's actually, if you haven't cleaned your birdhouses that are out there, I mean, rouse the mice out, clean them out, let them dry, and close them up, because the bluebirds have been back for a couple of weeks. And other things. I haven't seen swallows yet, so I assume with it being in the mid-80s on Friday, if they're right about that, lots of stuff will be back. So
and things are really popping in the gardens, and the flowers and everything are just really... really going to town after some good rains, at least in southern Wisconsin. I expect the same as we go north, too. We have Matt emailed to say that whitetail deer have devastated his gardens every year, short of creating a prison-like atmosphere in his yard with much fencing. Is there anything he can do? Now, if you go to the Craven homestead...
It looks like a prison, doesn't it?
There's a lot of fencing, but it does the job, doesn't it, Scott?
Well, it does. Deer in the garden are the least of my problems now. Although the deer are around and they walk around my fences looking longingly at what's in there, generally the rule of thumb has always been that the smaller the area you're trying to protect, the shorter the fence can be. So you don't need the 14-foot fence that they might put around an airport where they have to have. They have zero deer tolerance. I use 5-foot welded wire. I've had pretty good luck with that. If it became a problem, I'd extend the posts up and run a single wire strand above that. But certainly for most sized backyard gardens, 5 or 6-foot welded wire would work just fine. And
yours doesn't look bad.
It doesn't look bad. And frankly, the garden, that's what I have my straw bales up against now. So I have some support for the growing tomatoes. I trellis beans on it. It keeps the dogs out. It keeps the kids out. It doesn't keep the rabbits out, but that's another story. To tell you the truth, I mean, you can mess around with all sorts of repellents and covering individual plants and scare devices and whatever else, but the deer will circumvent all of those eventually, and the only, in my opinion, the only surefire solution is a fence.
Yeah, is a fence or perhaps a dog. If a dog that you can leave the dog out.
If the dogs are out and around, they'll usually keep things down, and, you know, the two labs that I've got, everything kind of steers clear when we're home. The problem is if we go to the cabin for a couple of days and you come back, it's like everything's out there watching. And say, okay, there goes the dogs and the car's out. Let's have it. And all of a sudden, and you can't have that because they can set you back months with a couple nights of feeding. So.
Absolutely. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn will be talking with the principal of a new high school that was designed especially for recent immigrants. Part of its mission is to prepare English language learners for college and careers, so that'll be at 2 o'clock today. Right now, taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. And the lines are filled, but the number is 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Let's turn to Judy in Racine next. Hi, Judy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Always enjoy when Scott's on. A couple years ago, my grandkids were out biking, and they came biking home. Grandma, you've got to come quick. There's something down in the sewer. So I walked over a couple blocks, and sure enough, down in the sewer were some ducklings. And at that particular, it was right at an intersection, and there were three sewers, you know, on three of the corners.
Yeah.
So I got down on my belly and tried to get the duckling out of the sewer. And while I was doing that, a passerby came by and saw what we were doing and lifted my grandson and lowered him into the sewer across from me. And I thought, oh, my goodness. Well, anyway, we succeeded in getting, I think we got 6 of these ducklings, which turned out to be wood ducks. And we took them to fellow mortals and called about a month later, and she said, yep, they did well. They're being released. So.
Yeah. And you see that.
You see it. Storm sewers are probably as traffic and storm sewers are the two things that get most ducks cross country. They don't usually nest really close to the water, but they go to the water as soon as the ducklings have hatched. So over the years, in calls to the office, I mean, we took some off the sixth floor of UW Hospital. We'd dig them out of storm sewers, under vending machines at convenience stores, you know, just about anywhere you could think of. But the storm sewers are the trickiest part. Sometimes you can get the grate off and lower somebody in. Sometimes you can, you know, whatever you have. But if they're in the storm sewer, they're doomed. So
There's no getting out of that.
That's one of the cases where intervention is warranted. It may be a little tricky. It may or may not be successful, but it's certainly warranted to give it a try. Otherwise, they're doomed. So,
thanks, Judy, for that story. Appreciate it very much. Dennis and Red Granite up next. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm wondering, as far as bears, what time of year do they mate? I never figured that out. And we were up in Marinette County last weekend. The wood ticks are out in force.
That's what I'm hearing. Apparently, there are a lot of ticks this year with a mild El Nino winter. So be forewarned, everyone who's going outside, ticks are going to be an issue.
Yeah.
Well, as far as the bears are concerned, the mating is usually actually in the spring, and then it takes a while for implantation, for the development process to occur. But the timing is all such that birth then is in the winter den when the female's in her den, and then the cubs emerge for the first time in the spring. So it's a long process.
So when a lot of other animals are having their little ones, that's about the
bears
mating.
Bears are just starting the process.
Yeah, they're just starting the mating process.
Well, what time of year, then, do these sows usually chase the yearlings away? Because we see a lot of bear in Marinette County June through the first part of July. Is that when they're actually pushing the young ones out?
Yeah, well, they usually when they emerge with the new cubs, then the yearlings are generally not tolerated anymore, and they're out on their own.
Yeah.
Okay.
There we go. Thanks, Dennis. Appreciate
it. There are plenty of bears. The population estimate, I just did a program on large carnivores at the Wild Birds Unlimited store last weekend, which seemed to attract a lot of attention, and did a little checking on bear numbers. I think the current population estimate is 28,500, which is a case, yes, and with all the cubs emerging, it's kind of like the situation we've talked with deer in the past. You kind of go from the annual low point in the population to the annual high point in a very short period of time.
Mark in Green Bay up next with something for us. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I'd like to talk about the spring turkey hunting vis-a-vis morel picking, flower watch looking, and bird watching. When it first started, there were 4 days a week, half days. That expanded to 5 days, half days. Now it's 7 days a week, half hour before sunrise to sunset, from April 9th through the 24th of May. And you have to, if you're going into the woods, you have to be aware that there are people out there in full camel, asleep under a tree. There's already been 2 injuries and, tragically, 1 fatality in turkey hunting this year. Mm-hmm. Why can't there be a sharing? Why can't there be 1 or 2 days during the week that people that don't want to be out there hunting can feel safe being in the woods?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'd have to counter it with the fact that there were just some statistics recently in the paper that as hunting goes, turkey hunting remains one of the safest forms of hunting in Wisconsin, in spite of that recent fatality and the incidents that you mentioned. But overall, given the participation rates and the distribution of turkey hunters on the landscape because of the zones and the permit allocation by period, it remains pretty safe. And I guess I have to say I hunt turkeys primarily on private land, but I'm just trying to think, other than occasionally seeing someone parked on the road or coming out of the woods, I have never run into a turkey hunter in the woods yet in,
well, here's my experience
15
in
years.
County. Here's my experience up in Door County this past week. I went to 3 public places. They weren't state. They were county spots. All of them had a car parked at them. I assume they're turkey hunters, so I didn't go in there because you can't see where they are. You can't find them. So I thought, well, I'll go to the park. go to the park, and there's a clapboard in the front of it saying, warning, hunting in progress. So where exactly is a person that doesn't want to have an encounter with a hunter supposed to go?
Well, again, I understand the question, and I understand your concern, but for one thing, turkey hunting tends to be concentrated early in the morning when the turkeys are first off the roost. I personally would not have a heartbeat's hesitation going on to any public hunting ground or piece of public land here in Dane County, for example, where there are a lot of people, at any time I wanted in the spring, other than around sunrise, to look for morels or watch birds or pick ticks off or whatever else I wanted to do. It would not faze me in the least, primarily or in part because I'm a turkey hunter. And yes, I'm completely camouflaged. I'm usually well hidden. And therefore, I can assure you that if you entered the woods where I'm hunting, I would see you and know you were coming a long time before you had any idea I was there, if you ever knew I was there in the first place, because I'd probably let you pass and go about your business without saying a word, other than that I might then pick up and go to another spot because of the disruption. But I, while I understand your concern, I think it's not as hazardous as you've perhaps decided that it is or suspected.
Yeah.
So, I think to think that Wisconsin as a whole is off limits because of turkey season is just unfounded. There aren't that many turkey hunters out there. Two-thirds of Wisconsin is private land anyway, and in that case, if you either have the land yourself or know the landowner, you'll know if there's anybody out there. And as far as the Great North Woods are concerned, turkey hunters are few and far between.
Yeah,
so
there we go. Thanks, Mark. Tom in Ashland up next. Tom, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just have a comment, and I'll let you guys talk about it, and I'll go off there. I just wanted to bring attention to, I live here in Ashland by Shawamigan Bay, which is a very fragile sort of ecosystem, a lot of fish, a lot of bird life, a lot of wildlife. And up here, just over the line in Bayfield County, there's a proposed confined animal feeding operation that would have a huge amount of hogs and produce a huge amount of waste. Situated right in the Fish Creek watershed, just a few miles from the bay. And up here, a lot of people are very concerned about the impact that could have on the bay and on the wildlife ecology, the fishing, the birds, et cetera. So just wanted to bring attention to that, and I'll let you guys talk about that off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Go ahead, Scott.
Oh, I was just to say I'm pretty familiar with that area because I do some programs up at the Great Lakes Visitor Center and around that area, and I know some of the local folks are very agitated about this, but I'm not that familiar with the specifics. These CAFOs, as they're called, are springing up in other areas too, and I assuming that, and this may be a gross over-assumption, that the people involved in regulating or permitting these things are assuring the areas that concerns over pollution or land use or noise or trucks or whatever other concerns there are taken care of. This is one of those things like landfills, CAFOs, nuclear power plants. It's the old, we got to have them because people want pork chops in this case, but not here.
Yeah.
So one would like to think that such things are being cited in the least environmentally sensitive areas that could possibly be located. It doesn't sound like that's the case in this one, but I don't have a great deal more to say than that.
Yeah, unfortunately. And, we have a cabin in Bayfield County, so it's certainly something on my own radar and something that will be looking at, and you hope that the process is one that leads to either not having it or having something that is environmentally safe. And And that basically
and even,
is about,
you know,
all
even
we can
at
say.
That, there are no guarantees.
No.
You have a tremendous confinement facility for, say, manure sludge, and then all of a sudden there's a 100-year storm. And so there are always possibilities for disasters, but I hope if this one goes through that they're as certain as they can be that it's insulated from the environment.
Let's go to Christine in Brookfield next. Hi, Christine. Thanks for calling.
Hey, love your show.
Thank you.
I just had a thought regarding the gardens. I live in the middle of a high traffic deer area, and to protect mine, I use berry netting. It's about, 8 feet tall, and I get those tall, skinny, thin green poles. They're really lightweight.
Uh-huh.
Just stick them in the ground and use bread ties to hold up the berry netting around my garden, and the deer don't come anywhere near it because they don't like how little it is, and it gets caught in their nose.
Right.
And then you don't have a visual barrier, and it's been really successful for me for the last 3 years, so that's my strategy.
Berry netting.
Yeah, it's like bird netting. You can get it in huge sheets or rolls at the garden centers, and it's very lightweight. I find it a little tough to use because it's so flimsy. You do have to reinforce it, and it catches. I find that if you touch it, just like the deer are concerned, if I brush by it, it catches on a button on your coat or something like that. So there are some issues with it, but it's inexpensive, much easier to install than, say, heavy welded wire fencing. And
keep the rabbits out.
it'll do that, too, but the best part is it can be repaired.
Yeah.
And number three, and you mentioned this, it's black. So from a distance, you can't see it. So in terms of the caller who was concerned, let's see, who was that, Matt, about the visual impact of a fortress, all you see is your support stakes, basically, because it kind of disappears in the background.
Yeah,
so,
there we go.
Good idea.
Thanks, Christine.
All right.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Have a great day. Dan in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi, this is Dan. Here's another wrinkle on the deer thing. You put chain link fence, you lay it on the ground, and then you put all your ornamentals in there, and you put all your deer candy and favorite plants on the inside of this barrier, and they won't touch it.
Oh, they don't like walking on the chain link.
It's kind of like the cattle guard principle, where you have a crossing on a road and the cattle won't go over these rollers or mesh that they use. Yeah, the deer don't like to step in that. So do you put it right on the ground, or do you try and support it and raise it up a few inches?
Put it on the ground, and then put your ornamentals, your grasses and stuff.
So that stuff will grow right through it, Larry,
and then they
don't like to walk on it.
Yeah, you got to kind of plan your garden. You know, if you've got a natural barrier where they can't get in, or trees, or, you kind of got to plan so that, but it does work.
See, all this creativity from our listeners is not only very interesting, but it's also born of the fact that deer are a major pain in the backside if you're trying to grow a garden. So these are born out of desperation.
Yeah, I had a lady that her neighbors put all the stinky stuff out, and it's like, and then it would rain, and they'd put stinky stuff out. And she put that down, and she thanked me emphatically every time she saw me.
Well,
love
thanks,
it, Dan.
Thanks. Another useful tip.
Yeah, appreciate it. And, chain link fence, I guess that's a little more expensive, but if you've got an old one,
it's a little
like
more
I
expensive.
Had.
I think the key there is that now what you're effectively doing is creating a 4 or 5 foot boundary around the core of your garden.
Yeah.
So you have to be prepared to either give up that space or try and use it the way Dan was describing. But I can imagine that might be fairly tricky to keep weeded, too, if you had a weed problem. But if you could keep the deer out, it's probably well worth a little bit of weeding effort.
And thanks again, Dan. Bob and Krivitz, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Do you ever watch the program Unusual Friends, either one of you gentlemen?
I have seen that show.
I have not.
I have an unusual couple up here at my cabin. I photograph animals as a hobby. And yesterday, going to the coffee shop, I'm on a dead end road. Okay, and a young yearling fawn or deer came out, and she stood in the middle of the road. Naturally, I stopped to watch them. And comes the hen turkey, and she waits for her at the center of the road, and they walk side by side down. And I've seen them 3 or 4 days together now, and they're. One gets ahead of the other a little bit, and then whether it's the turkey or the deer, and that female stop and wait for the the opposite one to catch up. I mean, they walk right next to each other.
They've That's been in pretty the cool.
Yard. I've seen it quite a few times on the road.
Unusual friends right there.
Yep, that's pretty neat. Pretty neat observation.
And every time you have a camera, you know, then they're not around, of course.
Yeah.
You know, but it's really neat to see. I've never seen something like that before.
That is interesting. Now that I remember the premise of the show, which is, you know, like a goat raising puppies or
whatever,
a tiger
yeah.
befriending a, you know, a house cat or things like that. So that's pretty neat. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. And well, Bob and Krivitz reminded me of my good friend Bob in Mount Horeb, who turkey hunting observed on a hillside looking down in a valley. Some deer and a turkey playing. The deer would kind of rush at the turkey and then run back, and then the turkey would go running over to the the deer and run back. So that he observed that for quite a long time, and they were really you could tell they were playing and having a good time. You can join in, too. Are you having a good time? I hope you are. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And we got open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Jill and Rhinelander, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a short fence around the garden, and there's a single-strand electric, you know, from a little fencer.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But the deer still jump it every once in a while, so what I do when that happens is take that thin plastic surveyor's tape and attach it on a post, and then I just kittywampus put this, not in a grid, but just back and forth across the garden in different directions, and then the deer stay out.
Yeah.
And when I want to get in the garden, all I have to do is pull that loop of the plastic stuff up, drop it on the ground.
Hmm. Very, very good.
And it doesn't cost a lot of money.
So you're talking about what people call flagging tape. It comes in thin plastic, comes in a big roll like normal tape, but it's not adhesive in any way.
Right.
It's just what you mark fence posts and things with.
Yeah.
Ah, well.
And that creates an illusion of something there, and they just stay out.
Well, and there is something there. The rabbits will get through, but
No, rabbits don't, because I have chicken wire around the bottom part of it.
Ah,
so,
there you go.
You know, but it's not a real tall fence.
Very cool.
Well,
so it does work, and it isn't expensive.
I love the idea. I love the creativity. Wisconsin Public Radio listeners are, if nothing else, they are very, well, they're nice, and they're also very creative. Very creative. Thank you again. We had Mark post in Facebook that he has a heavy-duty floating dock on a small, shallow stream. The dock has air pocket channels underneath, and I know what he's talking about. I'm sure you do as well, Scott. There's beaver and muskrat activity on the stream. Any recommendations to keep the critters out from under the dock? I don't know how you would do it.
We're talking about a floating dock here with these
floating docks,
plastic, you know, kind of squarish
pontoons,
barrel-like
probably
pontoons.
On the bottom.
There's a couple of things that are possible. If you think of it essentially as a deck over water, suspending some skirting of welded wire or galvanized wire down that could be tacked or attached to the edge of the dock.
I don't think you could attach it to the dock, though, because it's floating and it'd bounce up and down. You'd need to have it away from the dock a little bit. I know what you're saying, but I thought...
Yeah, anyway, if a mechanical skirt of some kind could be created so that they wouldn't swim in at the surface, of course, a muskrat or beaver could come up under it. But if that's the case, I'd be tempted to get a mesh bag, an onion bag, or mesh stocking or something like that, and put a handful of mothballs in it, and then just tie that up amidst the floats, because most mammals do not like that scent of the naphthalene or para that they're made out of, and it probably wouldn't bother anybody else. Don't put it in the water, but keep it up. keep it up right under the surface of the dock so that the smell would be there, and that might help too.
Yeah, not a, a good idea, actually. That is a good idea. We had, let's see, I was going to say, oh, several people have phoned in or emailed in to talk about the rabbit diseases, and you did mention
tularemia.
Tularemia, yeah. I think, is the rabbit fever that I guess, as you were saying earlier, it's a tick-borne or
it's
insect-borne.
It's parasite-borne. It can be a problem for humans, and so I'm suspecting that was the basis of the earlier call. But
yeah, I'm pretty sure you're right. We have Bob and Rhinelander up next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I had two comments. One of them was on going down into a sewer to help ducks. This is very dangerous. The gases formed in sewers are heavier than air, so they don't dissipate. They're odorless. Municipal workers going down into those confined spaces have to have a harness for rescue, because what happens is they're overcome by the gas, their partner goes down to help them, and they both die.
Yeah.
So no duck is worth that risk, especially for a child, which has a smaller susceptibility to those gases.
Yeah, I'm not talking about sanitary sewers here. We're talking about storm drains.
Even storm sewers produce those gases. The second one is about CAFOs. The one in Bayfield is a perfect example of why counties in the north need to be enacting ordinances in advance. This particular one had an application. They had to act on the application as the law was written during the application period. So even though they have since put on all kinds of restrictions, they're restricted there by the ordinance that was enforced at the time. And all over the north, there are counties, including my own in Oneida County, that don't have ordinances on CAFOs because there haven't been any. And these companies are coming up here because they want to get away from the diseases in Iowa or someplace, and they want to buy land for $2,000 an acre instead of $20,000 an acre, and most importantly, because these counties don't have ordinances on CAFOs.
Yeah.
We've got ordinances all over southern Wisconsin and eastern Wisconsin, but most of the rural counties in the north don't have them. So it's important to prevail on the zoning departments to put those ordinances in place before they get the first application.
It's and thanks for calling, Bob. It is a totally different topic than what we're dealing with today, and I'm obviously sensing there's a need for a discussion on this topic at another time. But I appreciate what you had to say about ordinances, because he's absolutely right about ordinances. Thank you again for calling. Larry by the way, we're going to take a quick break here, actually. Larry in Hixton, hang in there. We're talking today with Scott Craven, taking a look at the world of wildlife. Scott's an emeritus professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Again, Jill Nador, on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist. So happy to have him along, and thanks for joining us. You can call. We have an open line at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And I haven't checked the Facebook page in a while to see if we have any wildlife photos. So I'm going to do that right now as we take a call from Larry in Hixton. Hi, Larry. Thank you for calling. Whoops. First, we have to get you on the air here.
In our gross picture there, but I'm also a trapper, so I'm pretty familiar with all the wildlife in Trumbull County. But the last 2 days, very strangely, we've had what I would refer to as a juvenile badger just come into our backyard and snoop around underneath the bird feeders and snoop and smell of every mole hole and that kind of thing. Just an interesting observation, because badgers usually, at least my experience with them, is that they're not that much around humans. I'll just go off the air, but I thought I would let you know that it looks like a juvenile And he didn't do any harm to anything. It was just an interesting observation.
And he's not acting weird otherwise.
No. He didn't act like a rabid animal okay. would or that sort of thing, no.
Okay, good. Interesting observation.
Badger sightings are always cool.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting to see a live one in Wisconsin. I've seen some road-killed individuals, and people have brought them in to me for specimens, but I've not seen a live one yet. But people, if they're lucky enough to identify a den and then set up a trail camera or a blind, they can get some fantastic pictures. They're cool animals. And I guess the point that he made beyond just seeing the badger, if these animals, no matter what they are in your yard or passing through, and they're not, as he said, not doing anything that causes you any anxiety or problem, enjoy them for what they are and leave them alone. There's no reason to think, oh, my gosh, there's a badger in the yard. We've got to call badger control or whatever. You don't need to do that.
We have, I went online to our Facebook page because I had to see what photos we had. And Brett had something about keeping the animals away from the garden. His parents have a radio out in the garden, and it's tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And
keeps
that
everything out of the garden.
They hear Mueller and Craven talking, and they head for the hills. So somebody else told me that one year that they had did a similar thing, and it kept, the voices.
People will do it for raccoons, especially, as raccoons are very difficult to deal with. But you put a radio under an inverted bucket or something so it doesn't get wet, and
there you go.
Seems to help.
We have a great photo from Daniel who sent a photo of smelt. Yes, smelt ran great a couple of weeks back in Ashland.
Geez, look at that. That's the makings of a pretty good fry right there.
Absolutely. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You'll see that photo. And let's see, he has a photo here. This is my niece holding a morel. Her brother found this last week, and it looks like a huge...
That's a big one. Holy mackerel.
That is the biggest morel mushroom I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
That's big. Well, thank you for sending that photo.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
Uh-oh.
Oh, and here's another one of, we've got bluebells, asparagus, and morels. And that is, I tell you what, that'll make your mouth water.
I'll tell you what, Larry, there's a nice chucker partridge, too. That's the makings of one of my favorite spring dishes, some asparagus chunks, fresh morels sautéed in butter and then mixed with your favorite pasta and either just butter or a little Alfredo sauce. That's mighty fine.
Mighty fine.
Mighty fine.
And here we've got, look at here. This is from Carl. Sent a nice photo.
It's a chucker partridge.
Yeah.
Which is probably an escape from a local shooting club or game farm since they're not native to the area, but a very pretty bird.
And I don't know if we'll be able to hear this, but Jerry sent us... are we going to be able to hear it? No. We're not hearing the loons calling, but you know what? I think I've got some loons here. Let's go. Here's a loon clip.
Oh, there they are.
That is... There we go. Well,
that makes me anxious to get up to the cabin.
Yeah. And Bruce sent a beautiful photo. This is in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, that's not a local shot.
Trey Rio Wildlife Area in Phoenix, Arizona of, I'm not sure which.
Well, it looks like a little blue heron or a tricolored heron. I can't tell at this distance, but not a local scene.
So there we are, and we have a barred owl nest that Zach found and took a photo of. So there we go.
Wow.
We have got, and I haven't even gotten to all of that yet. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You're going to see lots of really cool photos of all kinds of things. And Scott, you were going to blab about something.
Just wanted to do a little shout out for a lot of, there's been a lot of publicity on this in magazines, newspapers, and on TV. But this year marks the 100th anniversary of the National Park System. And the relevance for our program is that these are some of the finest places in the country to go and see wildlife and see them up close and relatively undisturbed and be able to take pictures and just sit there as long as you want and observe things doing what they do without the normal kinds of human pressure that occur outside of national parks. So there are 59 national parks across the country, but when you add those to all the national monuments, historical sites, recreation areas, seashores, lakeshores, parkways, and so forth, is a lot of places to go. Here in Wisconsin, we're represented by the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, St. Croix National Scenic Riverway, and the Ice Age National Scenic Trail. And the final bit of advice for anybody who's listening who is 62 or over. Now, have you turned 62, Larry? I think you did just recently.
Just recently.
Anyway, if you're over 62 and a U.S. citizen and you haven't shelled out for your senior pass, the so-called America the Beautiful Pass is $10.
Yep.
And it's good for life. And it gains you and everybody in your vehicle free admission to any of these parks and facilities across the country. It is about as good a deal as there is available in the United States for $10. So if you don't have one, check it out. It's called the America the Beautiful Pass, and it's a good deal.
My advice is that when you do get that pass, remember where you keep it.
Yeah, well, that's another problem. But
that's a whole other story I could go into. But it is the best deal going. And if you lose it, you can just go buy another one for $10. What the heck? John in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, guys.
What's up with you today?
Oh, here's what I got. Thanks for taking the call. And I've got either a parakeet or a budgie, I don't know which one, coming to my feeder. Obviously, he's an escapee from somebody's house. And I've been feeding him along with all my other birds, just regular bird seed. And I can get pretty close to him, put my fingers up thinking maybe he'll perch and I can, you know, take him. Because I know come winter he'll be dead. Any advice on something like this where these guys start to habituate your feeders? I can take the answer off the air if you guys would like.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's not an uncommon thing. We have reports of canaries, parakeets or budgies. A few years ago, we had an African gray parrot that was flying around the Madison area. If you can find birds are very mobile, so there's, you know, it could be your next door neighbor, but it could be somebody a long way from you that you're not going to find. So if someone happens to be looking for it, or maybe they hear about it on the program here and get a hold of you, then there are various ways the bird could be trapped and captured and maybe returned to its owner, or you could take it into captivity and find a home for it, because you're right, it's not going to survive the winter, but it's only the 1st of May, so it's got a good long time here to make it in the wild. If you can get it tamed down or figure out a way to lure it into, something as simple as a wire cage trap with a stick, the old way kids used to try and catch things with a string on a stick, you could certainly do that. As an exotic, you could do it and make it a pet. So appreciate your concern. It'll be fun to watch as it's using your feeder, but if you choose to try and catch it, you can go from there.
Yeah,
I appreciate that. I've actually set up a cage, an old dog cage I've got, and kind of sprinkle a trail of bird seed to it. And he's thinking about it. I can get within about 2 feet of him, and he'll look at me, but not quite ready to jump onto my finger or the cage. So I'll be patient. See what happens.
Give him a little time. Consider it a project, and you'll eventually get him.
Are you on the east side of Madison?
North? No, I'm on the west side of
west
Madison,
side.
Off Fish Hatchery, that side of town. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I just mentioned that because someone else called in once with a bird that they lost their bird, and they were out looking for it. And afterwards, she told me that several people from the neighborhood said, "Oh, I just heard this on Larry's show." So they were helping her look for the bird. Anyway, we have Barb in Cascade up next with a comment or question. Barb, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. We have a pair of robins nesting on our front porch, which is fine. We've had nesting robins for years there. We just let them do it. But the male of this pair cannot stop attacking our front windows.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well,
he attacks all day long, every 30 seconds. And first of all, I'm afraid he's going to hurt himself. And secondly, it's annoying.
Yeah. Well, it's incredibly annoying. It's also incredibly common. And I would guess over the years of the program, Larry, in the spring, this is the most common question we get. It's often robins, but it can also be cardinals, orioles, or a number of other birds, where the male becomes very territorial, protecting its nest site, and what it does is see its reflection in your windows. And as far as the robin's concerned, that's an intruding male. He's looking at himself, but he views it as an intruding male in his territory, and he attacks it. And after he hits the window and bounces off and gets back on his perch and looks, son of a gun, he's still there, and bang, into the window again. And they'll do it for hours on end. And it can get to the point when it's raining that there's mud all over your window. Sometimes the birds injure themselves, and then there's blood and mud and feathers, and it is a problem. However, there are things you can do about it. You can deaden the reflection in the window, at least for the time being, even by covering a couple of windows.
Drop some netting over it.
You can drop some of this bird netting we were talking about a little earlier for deer protection. Cut a sheet of that and hang it down like a drape in front of the window and put something to space it so that it's 3 or 4 inches from the glass. That will also solve the problem. But maybe the easiest thing you can do to get some ideas is go to the American Bird Conservancy's website, and they have a national project on this window and bird strike issue. And on their website, you can find all of the products available nationally to solve this problem.
So it's the American Bird Conservancy. American Bird Conservancy. Scott Craven, our guest, he's going to be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Scott. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist, emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest, and talking wildlife with him and having a lot of fun doing it. You may have a question or comment. I hope you'll join in. We were just talking before our news break about all the great photos that have come up on our Facebook page, and a few more have come up. Cheryl Patterson sent us some pretty cool photos there as well, Scott.
Yeah, nice.
Nice bird. What is that? Those are not
like
geese.
Swans.
They're swans.
Yeah. And there's the geese.
And there's some geese. So we have swans and geese and a giant morel mushrooms, a little bit of everything. And so I hope you'll take a look at it on our Facebook page.
That morel has inspired me to...
Oh, man.
Now, on the one hand, there's giant morels, but on the other hand, the other listener said the woods were full of ticks. I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, there's a one thing that I do every year is, like for turkey hunting or when you're going to be spending some time and, you know, significant time, I buy a can of this permethrin and spray the heck out of my pants and coat and cap outside, of course, and let it sit overnight. And then, you know, the next day and for a couple weeks after, supposedly wood ticks or any ticks would be killed if they come in contact with it, but it's safe for an individual.
Hmm.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that's a fantastic idea, Larry.
For
you. I may try something, but it just occurred to me that from the show, I've got to hot-foot it over to Lafarge. I'm speaking tonight at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve on wildlife interactions and people and wildlife and whatnot. And
oh,
so
cool.
It's at 7 o'clock, so if any of the listeners are out around Lafarge, we'll be there tonight. But it's a two-hour drive out there, and I might see some prime morel habitat on the way out.
On your way.
Yeah.
Ah, you rascal, you.
well, there you have
don't
it.
Go on, don't go on private property unless you get permission.
Absolutely not.
Larry in Oak Creek, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about wood ducks. We have 3 wood duck houses along the lake. They're fairly close to the house, so we can watch them pretty regularly. But my question is, what happens to the babies once they leave? the neighbor told me that the hen will pick the babies up and put them back in the nest if they leave too soon, but I've never been able to see them or anything.
Hmm.
So I was just kind of wondering what happens to them. Obviously, they come back to the nest at night, and in the morning they leave, but I never see any of the babies.
Now, once the ducklings have hatched, whether it's a duck on the ground in a nest or ducklings in a wood duck box or any of the other cavity nesting ducks like a hooded merganser, once they bail out of there, they are gone and gone for good. And at that point, the hen gathers them all up and they head off into the local marsh, wetland, pond, or whatever, where the brood actually grows up and eats and develops. They don't ever go back to the box.
Okay.
So once they're gone, they're gone. If you're lucky enough to see them bail out, and the hen usually bails out and then it'll get down on the ground and call them out, and the ducklings will plop, bail out one right after another, and then they gather up and away they go. I mean, you know, some human-induced wood duck or human-placed wood duck boxes are usually not that far off the ground, and if they're over water, they're only 4 or 5 feet up, so bailing out is no problem. But when you see them bail out of a natural tree cavity, 20, 25, 30 feet up in a tree, it's really something to see.
But and they make it.
They bounce like a rubber ball when they hit the ground and get up and shake it off and gather up with the rest of the brood, and away they go.
So I don't have to worry about my 10-foot high box.
Nope, not at all.
No, not at all.
And I saw my first Oriole yesterday, Baltimore Oriole, yesterday in Eustisford. So they're back.
They're back. Thank you. Thanks, Larry.
Excellent.
Great stories. And wood duck, and you know, it's sort of like the bluebird boxes. The wood duck boxes have been, I think, a good success story.
Oh, and back in the mid part of the last century, wood ducks were all but gone. But
yeah.
The tremendous national effort to build and erect wood duck boxes was a major contributor to their recovery.
Yeah, they're sure a beautiful bird.
Yep.
Trevor in Lake Geneva, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, guys. I'm a first-time listener. Just want to say I love the show. I got some advice for the guy with the close dock, the beavers and the muskrats. I got a buddy who, he has a similar floating dock where a river meets a farm pond. And what he did was took them onion sacks, you know, the mesh ones, and filled it with a bunch of empty soda bottles, and he floated them up under the hollow spots of his dock, and that seemed to work.
Oh, okay. So like bobbers underneath, and then they've filled the space so the muskrats and that wouldn't get in there.
Yep, and it worked perfect for him. He, just like I said, he filled a couple onion sacks with floating soda bottles and pushed it up under the hollows, and it worked. So just a little advice.
Oh, that's worth a try.
Okay, so I suppose anything from a foam block that you could cut to fit to anything that would fill the space then would solve
work
the problem.
Perfect.
Okay.
Yeah. All right,
well,
thanks, Trevor.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Trevor. And, you know, who doesn't have a whole bunch of those plastic bottles around? You just keep the caps.
Yeah.
Cap them. Karen in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have two questions and a comment. I know that there are classes offered around the state for the public in wildlife and bird watching. Are they offered by the DNR or are they offered by a private conservation group?
I don't mean to sound confusing, but the answer is yes, because there are many places that offer classes and opportunities to learn about all sorts of aspects of wildlife management around your home or on your private land or birding or lots of other topics. And I'm trying to remember when the Great Wisconsin Birding Festival up in Ashland, for example, I think they offer close to, dozens of classes and field trips up in Ashland. And all of the various, Wisconsin's blessed with a lot of really good nature centers, virtually every region, at least, if not county. So places like Bay Beach and the Ridges and Beaver Creek and Todd Weir in Milwaukee, there are, or the Arboretum here in Madison, or the Aldo Leopold Nature Center. There are all sorts of programs for the public. And the DNR also offers a lot of them. at various places like Tree Haven up in Tomahawk.
Weren't there ones you had to sign up early in the spring, or they were full?
Okay, well, one that you may be talking about that we've talked about on the program, and I know Larry has, are the some 150 classes and tours. I think it's actually 180 this year, offered by the Natural Resources Foundation.
Yeah, they do a wonderful job.
And they publish a list in the DNR magazine and also a separate little booklet format. And those fill up, yes, the Natural Resources Foundation.
Okay.
And you could check their website and get to that booklet that way. But those do fill up very quickly. In fact, Larry and I were just talking about one that I'll be offering in August that I think is full now. So you may have, that door may have closed, but there are lots of other places through the DNR, the nature centers, UW Extension, field stations like UW Milwaukee, lots of places that offer programs like that.
Yeah.
Great idea. It's probably cheaper too.
A lot of them you'll find are free for just attending.
This weekend at Horicon Marsh is their birding festival.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
So 3 days you've got tons of things going on for three straight days at the at the Horicon Wildlife Center. I just had the communications director on the other day to talk about this, and it's all free, or a lot of it's, most of it's free. It's going to cost you a little bit, but I mean, you're in Madison, you're not that far from Horicon Marsh.
No.
And it's this whole week. If you go to, go online to Horicon Marsh, there's a Horicon Marsh, I forget what the website is, but just type in Horicon Marsh. You'll get the website. You'll get all of the, there's like literally hundreds of many events, not only the DNR, but there's a birding group.
Well, that's all in relation to National Migratory Bird Day.
Yes.
Which occurs at this time of year. And these nature centers and other places that we're talking about all kind of do something in honor of National Migratory Bird Day. So
if you have time this weekend, you've got lots of things to keep you busy. So good luck, Karen. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, we were just talking about that the other day, and it sounds like so much fun. Tom in Washburn up next. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
What's on your mind? Thanks for calling.
Well, yes, thank you for having me. I was calling with an antidote for that we use up north when we grow produce and sell it and that stuff, but for repelling deer. And it is using the liquid fence, but what we do is we soak twine, baling twine in it, overnight for about 24 hours, and then you tie that and put in your garden, and it doesn't wash out. It likes to stay on there for a good 2 months.
The
wind kind of disperses the scent as it blows.
So now do you string it like fencing, or do you just hang?
Oh, yeah, we just cut it in strips, maybe 2 foot long, and just let it dangle off the stakes and maybe tie two to each stake and just do our plots that way, and it actually works quite well.
Oh, well, it's
worth it. Because we plant about 5 acres, so... We got to come up with something,
and so it is just plain old baling twine.
Baling twine, yep.
And
the
liquid fence,
twine, not the polymer stuff, but the regular,
right,
old fashioned, yep,
hemp type stuff.
And it soaks in there and stays in there very well.
Tom, another great suggestion. Thank you.
I just want to offer up a caution. I mean, we've had lots of good ideas for dealing with deer problems, and all of them have merit in some places at some times. And I guess the cautionary statement I'm trying to make is if you're in an area with a very high deer density or the deer are pressed for food, you're going to find any of these techniques to be a real challenge.
Yeah.
So, again, something that works great in a low-density deer situation where there's lots of other stuff around in terms of agricultural lands and so forth may not be the miracle cure for some other places. But
and
they're,
then some
all,
of the
they're
fencing
all worth a
too,
try.
The fencing we were talking about earlier, the netting, you know, if a deer runs into that.
Yeah, I saw there was a caller up, but we've apparently lost them. But the caution was that this plastic netting can be a hazard to some wildlife, and it gets
birds
back to my describing it as kind of snaggy and clingy, and the fact that it's nearly invisible at a distance because it's so fine and it's also black.
Yeah.
So in some cases, if you get this in a flight path, for example, where a bird thinks it can go right through, it operates like a gill net for fish, and the birds can get entangled in it. And if a deer's running through and they don't see it, then your fence is down, the deer's tangled up, it's a heck of a mess. So this is just another example of where these things work terrific for person A in setting A. In setting B with person C, that you may be fraught with difficulty. So be careful with some of this stuff.
Tom in Oshkosh, thanks for calling. Hi, what's on your mind?
Yes, sir. I'd like to comment about the so-called false the morel mushroom on your Facebook page.
Yeah.
And I do believe that is the poisonous false morel. It's the Gyromitra esculenta, and it is poisonous.
Let me see. We're going to have to...
I'm too far from the screen. It looks like a giant morel to me, but it could very well be. Now, the false morels, those are solid, aren't they, if you cut them?
Yes, the stem is solid on the inside.
Okay, I can't see that from the distance here, but certainly anybody who gathers mushrooms ought to be aware of the fact that one of the reasons morels are so popular is because they're generally easy to identify and concentrated in the season. But if this is, you apparently know about these things, if you've looked at it and it appears that way to you, then I'm good with that. But I simply can't tell from the picture.
If you cut it open, once they're cut open, you're going to be able to tell.
Okay.
Yeah, the morel is hollow inside.
Right.
Yeah.
And the top of this mushroom looks like a brain.
Yep.
And the Gyromitra esculenta, the poisonous one, the false morel, looks like a brain.
It could well be.
Well, it could well be.
So hopefully we
might want to send an email to the person holding it.
or send a comment. Well, you know, it's probably already been consumed.
I'm going to get up, Larry, and look a little more closely.
All right. So while Scott's doing that, I'm just going to remind you that you can join in, too. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. You can post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mehler Show. All kinds of ways to do it. And the email address, of course, is talk@WPR.org. And did you get a better look, Scott?
I got a better look, but I still can't tell. But it certainly looks pretty solid the way she's gripping it. And it doesn't look like any morel I've ever seen.
No.
Certainly both by size and texture, so I don't know.
Well, Tom bringing it up, it's a good thing for anybody out there who finds mushrooms and thinks they're morels versus the false morel. If you cut those in half, the regular morels are they're hollow.
Right.
You're not going to...
Stem and the cap.
Stem and cap.
Yep.
So that was really worth talking about, for sure. Thank you so much for bringing that up. And we've got... here's another photo. Finally got a snake photo up there, Scott. We've got... Karen sent us a photo. Our garter snakes, or garden snakes, as she calls them, sun themselves on our Carpenter Ridgeway neighborhood in Madison. I don't mind them when I post photos like the attached. My Facebook friends think it's awful. But
what the heck? I mean, this gets back to the gentleman who saw the badger and made the comment, well, they're not causing a problem. And in this case, the photographer's not bothered with them. So why, you know, sometimes you do need to be a little cautious that the presence of a large number of garter snakes, for example, near a home may indicate that there's a hibernaculum somewhere in the foundation or walls or whatever else, and that would get some people agitated. But if they're just out there catching a few rays and then disperse about the neighborhood, no problem.
We had Jeff made a comment to the folks, the mushroom hunters who are worried about turkey hunters, and frankly, I wouldn't have a concern. But he suggests to make maybe feel better, go to your local hardware store, sporting goods store, and purchase a highly visible vest.
Right, it's a good idea.
Put that vest on,
or just a blaze orange cap.
It's pretty good protection for sure. Bruce in Monona, and by the way, the person that was shot was another turkey hunter.
Yes.
And
chasing a wounded bird, I heard.
Yeah. Yeah. Bruce in Monona, your turn. Thanks, Bruce, for calling.
Hi, Larry. It's Bruce Fritz, actually. I used to work with Renee.
Oh, hi, Bruce.
Nature365.tv is a website that Jim Brandenburg has put up, and he was a geographic photographer for 20, 30 years. This issue, the April issue of Geographic, the last story in it is 93 Days of Spring, which are still pictures by Brandenburg, and he's been part of a WPR or public yeah. TV bonus thing, whatever. But anyway, he's been shooting video every day at his place alongside a waterfall and overlooking his own wolf pack and all the land he owns up in Ely, Minnesota. And every day for 3 years, he's been shooting video for, I don't know how long he shoots, but 2 years of it he gave to a French editor who then, that's now available for everyone to go and see, but it's also those you have to pay for. But the ones right now at 365, or nature365.tv, are available free. You just sign up and they shoot it to your email every day, and it's the best way to start your day because it's how the day is and how the nature is unfolding every single day.
Oh, that's really cool, Bruce.
Yeah.
So Nature 365?
Yep, 365, just so N-A-T-U-R-E, 365.tv.
Oh, thank you, Bruce.
Sign up, and I can't imagine anyone not loving what they see, and it's everything. It's hard to describe. I mean, from foxes and wolves to, you know, crows and fish and the ice breaking up and sandhill cranes migrating through by the thousands, snow geese go by through by the thousands. And this year, once you've got the URL in there and looking at the current day, if you watch what's in your screen at the top, if you just change the date in the URL, then you can go backwards. You could probably see all of this year's for free if you do it right.
Oh, Bruce, thanks so much. Scott and I were both writing all this down, and I have to say, Bruce Fritz is one of the real great photographers.
Thank you.
A Pulitzer Prize winner, and
no, I didn't win. I was nominated.
Yeah, nominated. Sorry, that's right.
Up that year.
One of the great photos. Political photos of all time, I thought. But Bruce, thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. He's a great guy, too. So, nature365.tv. And Gary in Ween, you got some bad news for us.
Yes. Well, first, I want to tell you guys, I love the show. And thanks, Scott, for giving the shout-out. Shout out about the Park Service. I've been to almost every national park west of Mississippi and have camped in 115 different national forests.
Oh.
My call is about poison ivy. We were up in northern Taylor County 2 weekends ago. We had that nice warm Sunday. And I was with some friends from Hayward, and we were out in the river wading, although it was cold. And I was, of the four of us, I was the only one who sat down on the shore when we came off. The other ones just sat on rocks. And 3 days later, I got...
Why is that ivy?
Showed up.
Oh, you know what? We're out of time, but the takeaway message from that is poison ivy is out, even in the far north.
It's out, and people better be cautious, especially if they're sensitive like I am.
Yeah. Thanks, Gary. We are totally out of time. Scott, always a pleasure. Next time we talk with you, you'll be in the North Woods, and we'll be contacting you from there.
I think it'll be the day after the 4th of July or pretty close to it. So we'll figure out some way to do the show.
Scott Craven, our guest, he'll be back right around the 4th of July, and we'll do this all over again with him. And thanks a lot for listening. Our consumer protection experts will be with us to talk about the latest scams and answer all your consumer questions tomorrow at 11. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.